You're listening to Central. I'm here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, adopting kids can be complicated. Transracial adoptions can add additional challenges. How do parents and kids reckon with a process that's becoming increasingly common? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, when was the last time you saw something that took your breath away? A moment when you were captivated, shocked, and amazed by something exceptional, when you felt a sense of awe? Turns out these experiences can be really good for our well-being, an important part of how we navigate through life. And it doesn't take a trip around the world to find some awe in our own lives. In his new book, our guest shares years of research into the causes and benefits of awe, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What is a sight, a sound, an experience, maybe a memory that filled you at some point with wonder, with awe? What did it feel like to you? What questions do you have about why we have this sensation, this emotion? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Keltner is professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, director there of the Greater Good Science Center. His new book is called Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. He started his academic career at UW-Madison. Dr., welcome to Central Time and welcome back to Wisconsin.
It's good to be with Packers and Badger fans out there, Rob. It really is. It's nice to be with you. Thanks.
Now, I think we all have a sense of what awe is, and some of us, like me, overword the use awesome. Can you define your working definition? What is awe?
Tough question, you know, and great thinkers have been grappling with this for thousands of years. And so to update it to contemporary times, I define awe as the emotion, as you said, Rob, in the introduction, that we feel. In response to things that are vast and that transcend our understanding of the world or that are mysterious.
What led you to take this years-long interest in the sensation of awe?
Well, you know, part of it is personal. I grew up in a very awe-filled home in the late 60s. My mom taught literature and romanticism and Wordsworth and the like. My dad was a painter and loved Goya. And so I was just filled with the awe of the humanities. But I'm a scientist, and I, like Jane Goodall and Einstein and others, feel that in many ways this is the most essential human emotion, right? It is a fount of creativity and thinking about the future and the imagination and being part of a community. And so I wanted to study it scientifically and try to figure out what it does for us.
That seems like it's something that would be really hard to do. I don't know when I can predict awe is going to happen. It's probably not when I'm sitting in a lab with some researchers.
Yeah, and we failed a lot, you know, and we brought people into the lab, like, here's a big, you know, big screen image of fractals. And they're like, what is this guy doing? You know, so we relied on the wonders of the world. And we have studied people near Yosemite and looking out at great views, the Great Wall of China, you know, dancing, listening to music at festivals and the like. So we've gotten to awe spots, if you will, to try to understand what this emotion does for us.
And what I love about the research you've done also is that you've talked to people and interviewed people and gone on rafting trips and gone into prisons with people to try to figure out when they have awe. What are some of the common global themes that people talk about when it comes to sources of awe?
Yeah, you know, what a astute read of the book. Thank you. You know, I am a scientist and I rely on measurement and physiology, but I really felt like a lot of the measures didn't capture the spirit or essence of awe, this mysterious emotion. And so, like William James, a great American thinker, I started to gather stories. And I gathered stories from 26 countries around the world, from Mexico to India. I gathered stories from veterans and prisoners and indigenous scholars and ministers and the like. And what we found, and I think it's a great roadmap for our listeners to find more awe, is that you can find awe in eight wonders, which are people's moral beauty, their kindness and courage, nature, collective movement, when we all cheer for the Packers or the Badgers together, that's awe-inspiring, music, visual design or art, and then spirituality. And then finally, our final two of the eight wonders are big ideas, right? Like the idea of free markets or Marxism or evolution, and then life and death, which really surprised us that we are awestruck by the beginning of life and we are awestruck by when it ends.
Talking to Dacher Keltner about his new book, Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. You can call in if you have an awe-inspiring experience from your life to share with us, or a question about why we have the sensation. How to get there, call 800-642-1234. Dacher, I think I could have predicted, you know, nature, of course, music. Yeah, I feel that. The one that surprised me, I wouldn't have thought of, and it sounds like it's one of the most common ones, is moral beauty, seeing someone else do something good. And I was hoping you could expand on that.
Yeah, that caught us by surprise, too. You know, I was expecting, you know, nature, spirituality to be kind of the core sources of awe around the world. But in fact, it's this interesting category called moral beauty, where you see somebody be really kind. You know, they share their last few dollars with an unhoused individual. You see courageous acts. You know, we had act stories from the battlefield of soldiers and the like. You see people overcoming obstacles. I remember this mom from Ireland writing about her daughter who was born with club feet. And there she was 12 years later, watching her dance on stage and just crying and goosebumps and overcome with awe. And I think what that tells us, Rob, is we are wired to be moved to the better angels of our nature, to be good by the goodness of others. It's just this deep instinct, if you will, to tear up, to be moved, to want to do better when we observe others' moral beauty. So what a lesson for us, you know, in this time when we spend too much time looking at Instagram and comparing our vacation to the fancy retreat vacation of somebody else, to, you know, remember how much goodness there is out there.
And that's one of the most inspiring parts of the book, I thought, because, you know, I'm never going to do a painting that's going to cause awe. I'm a musician. Yeah. I'm not that good. But so note that my music isn't going to create awe. But if we want to find ways to inspire awe in other people, we do good stuff in front of them.
Yeah. And, you know, this is deep, right? The humans, when we observe other people share and speak on behalf of the people who are left out or downtrodden or act in a courageous way, we tear up, it activates our physiology, it activates regions of the brain that want us to lead us to imitate those actions, right? So in some sense, these are very contagious tendencies of other people's moral goodness spreading through communities. And then you start to answer one of the questions you raise, which is why awe? Because it spreads through communities' actions that make us strong together.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Eau Claire. Steve, hi.
Hi. You know, I'm quite old. Decades ago, I realized that, you know, when you smoke some pot, you feel a general sense of awe. But then I wonder if that limits your ability to feel awe if you're not using drugs. I mean, this has been decades since I smoked pot, but I remember the sensation that, oh my God, this is awesome. But then if you're not smoking pot, it takes, you know, a lot of time for that reservoir of the ability to feel awe to build back up again.
Interesting, Steve. Dacher, a double-edged sword if we're seeking that feeling of awe in a substance.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, I tell you where this is really active in terms of people thinking about awe is in psychedelics, you know, the indigenous plant medicines, the synthesized LSD and the like. And awe is elicited by these substances. It in part accounts for their benefits. And for a lot of people, that's good news, right? If you're working with trauma or the like. But I always, you know, I think one of the lessons of the book is there are 8 pathways to awe, right? Be it nature, looking at a storm on a Wisconsin, you know, prairie, or, you know, watching virtue on the football field or the like. And let's not forget, you know, that how rich the opportunities for awe are alongside those who are interested in the effects of different kinds of drugs.
Steve, thanks for that call. We're talking to psychology professor Dacher Keltner about his new book. It's called Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. We'll get into some of that transformation coming up, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this sensation, this emotion we call awe? Do you have a moment to share in your life that you think back on? And yeah, that inspired awe, or is there something you go to? Maybe it's nature or a piece of music or art, or you fill in the blank at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dacher Keltner, psychology professor at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is Awe, the new science of everyday wonder and how it can transform your life. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about awe and wonder, or maybe your own experiences, 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Brad is with us in Glendale. Hi, Brad.
Hi, yes. Last week, my wife and I were in Rome for a few days, and I'd been there many years before, but we went to the Colosseum, and it was, I said I'd been there before, but I was awestruck, and my wife was. It was like, this is incredible. The engineering that's involved, it was like, wow, this incredible building. And then we were also struck by the fact that this incredible, awesome building was constructed so that people could enjoy human beings and animals kill each other.
Brad, thanks a lot for that call. And Decker, this overlap or neighborhood anyway between awe and horror is not uncommon, you write.
Not at all. I mean, you know, we took a lot of care to differentiate awe from other closely related states like beauty, which it's different from, you know, and horror. And, you know, the horror is about destruction and death, and awe is really about mystery and vastness, and they really can be pulled apart. And, you know, one of the really interesting veins of thinking is that we rely on spectacle in more brutal times in human history, like the, you know, the gladiator times where it was horrifying and people could take that in. And now we rely on, you know, artistic forms of horror, be it horror films or the like, just to kind of contemplate on these about these, the death and perils of human existence and how it initiates our sense of wonder about why it happens. So, you know, humans have always been contemplating horror in these kinds of places and hopefully stirring our better capacities for wonder.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience, Brad, at 800-642-1234. Decker, I want to get into the benefits of experiencing awe. We get something out of it, apparently.
Oh, man. You know, this is why, in part, why I wrote the book, you know, Rob, because, you know, I've taught human happiness to tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people online and in classes and so forth. And it always boils down to a question, you know, of all this stuff in the new happiness literature, what can I do to better my life? And now, you know, I say, go find some awe. You know, awe makes you feel less stress, less physical pain. Veterans feel less trauma after a day of rafting for awe, as do under-resourced teenagers. You feel like you have more time. Your heart is functioning better. Your immune system has a better profile, and so on. So, you know, 5 minutes of awe is about as good for you as I think anything you can do, and important for us to remember.
Let's go back to our callers. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. I actually have just I thought of a third example. The most awe moment of my life was 25 years ago when I gave birth to my child, my daughter. That definitely was awe. The variety, I'm always in awe when I look at the variety of different animals and insects and birds. It's just amazing to me. And then the last thing is I'm in awe of our body systems and what's involved in the parts of the ear, the eye, our, you know, the lungs, everything. It's just amazing to me. So,
Elizabeth, thanks so much. Elizabeth Decker giving us, I think, a roadmap for a lot of the rest of our conversation here. First of all, the birth of her child. This is a common source of wonder and awe, it sounds like.
It is. And, you know, and I suspect Elizabeth is kind of an awe seeker with all
sounds
of those
like
examples. you know, around the world, people are awestruck by the emergence of a child, you know, 7 pounds coming out of the womb. Suddenly, you have a life there. And what's really interesting in stories in China and Russia and Japan and the United States and Mexico and elsewhere is it really has this similar quality to it where people are awestruck by the birth of a child and they want to serve. They want to be better. They want to feel responsible. They want to take care of things. And that's a common property of awe across the eight wonders. And we need more of it, right? We need to activate these what William James called the saintly tendencies of humans to care. And it certainly comes full on in the birth of a child.
And she also mentioned a couple of things. She mentioned the variety of animals together and the interconnected parts of the human body. And that takes me to actually a quote I wanted to throw at you here that I think is, well, anyway, I'll read it. Our default mind blinds us to this fundamental truth that our social, natural, physical, and cultural worlds are made up of interlocking systems. Experiences of awe open our minds to this big idea. This is from your conclusion. I hope it's not a spoiler. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of thinking about thinking that, you know, one form of thought is rational and reductionistic and analytical. It breaks things into its parts. And another kind of thinking is systems thinking. It sees the whole picture. It sees how different processes are working together. You look at an ecosystem, you know, the Arboretum in Madison, and you see all these systems working together of animals and flora and fauna. And awe opens us up to the big systems of life time and time again. Be it, you can have an experience in nature, right? You see a storm roll over the Wisconsin and you're like, wow, that was, and suddenly you see how you're part of a social system. I'm part of a community. And then Elizabeth's example is really on point, as you sort of discern, Rob, which is she's awestruck by all the systems of the body, the auditory system, the visual system, the heart, you know, and they are incredible. And awe does this vital work of opening the mind to the awareness of all the systems around us. Music is a system, right? It's all these notes creating sound and meaning. And when we feel awe, we pick up those themes in music.
Talking to Dacher Keltner, his new book is called Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. We had a call from Marissa who couldn't stay on the line, who says, I practice mindfulness and can get myself to have an awe-type feeling on my own. Did anyone in your studies demonstrate that as well?
Yeah, you know, it's that wonder of spirituality and contemplation, you know, and people find awe in ritual, in the church, in thinking about sacred texts, which is a form of contemplation or mindfulness. Very rich in the indigenous traditions. I learned from Dr. Yuria Saliedwin, who I interview in the book, an indigenous scholar, and in meditation and yoga. Yoga has a great tradition, thousands of years old, practiced by tens of millions of kundalini, of like this awesome energy that you create with yoga. So a lot of the contemplative or mindful traditions, one of the things they're after is to give us a chance to feel awe and for good benefit.
One feeling of awe I remember, I was on the shores of Lake Superior at night, moonless night, great sky. I just read about ancient Incans like using the Milky Way as part of their astronomy and calendars and stuff. And I look up and there's the Milky Way. And this sense like they were looking at thousands of years ago and people 1,000 years from now will be looking up at that connection with something bigger than ourselves, maybe more permanent than ourselves. Is that part of awe?
You know, if the reader were to take one idea from this book, it's to connect to things that are bigger, as you said, Rob, than yourself. We are in a self-focused time, you know, in this culture, to a lot of detriment, or it causes a lot of problems, self-focus. Awe makes us open to things that are bigger than ourselves, right? The galaxy, an ecosystem, a group of fans. Oh, they're the Packer fans. I'm part of that group. A musical piece. And I think, you know, part of our hunger right now in our culture is for that, is to reawaken our thinking about what are the big things that I want to connect to in life. They're all different for every individual. And awe points us in the direction.
I got to say, my assumption coming in, Dacher, is awe, yeah, that's lovely, but it's going to find us when it finds us. Clearly, reading your book, you make the case that no, we can go out and find it. Can you give us some like practical steps? How can we go cultivate some awe maybe tonight?
Yeah, you know, first just allow yourself some time. Just don't label things. Open your mind. Ask questions and go on walks to places that might surprise you or be a little mysterious and different. Tell awe stories. One of my favorites is, you know, with whomever you're with, just ask what their first childhood experience of awe was and see what it tells about them. Look out at clouds in the sky and the light, right? Look, or storms passing over in Wisconsin or the snow. Pick a piece of music. I love this, where I ask people whom I teach, like, what's a piece of music that really brought tears to you and why? And share that with some other people or listen to it yourself. So many, you know, and of course, meditation and spiritual practice. So many ways to get there for this invaluable essential emotion.
Then I want to bring things home. You use science to study awe. You also talk about how the emotion of awe has inspired scientists over the years. We think of science, oh, it's this rational, reasonable step-by-step thing. You say emotions and awe in particular are vital to science.
Yeah, you know, and in fact, not only science, but a lot of the great thinking in the world begins with an awe-inspiring epiphany. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you know, thought about society and the Industrial Revolution, was like, oh my God, it's a disaster, and advocated for something else. Scientists are always moved by awe, or many, very often. Newton and Descartes, their minds were blown by rainbows, and they did a lot of math and color theory to figure out how it is that light bends through water and creates color spectrums. And then Darwin, you know, his thinking about evolution began in many ways in just being awestruck by, you know, the Amazonian forest and what he called tangled banks of flora and fauna by a river. So awe is often the beginning of our best thinking.
Dacher, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for the great questions, Rob, and great to be part of Wisconsin once again.
Wonderful. That's Dacher Keltner, professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, director of the Greater Good Science Center. He joined us to talk about his latest book. It's called Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. We mentioned sharing a story of awe or a song that inspires awe in you or whatever. Still time for you to do that. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org with your story of a moment of awe in your own life. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Governor Evers wants more public school funding. Republican lawmakers want more voucher school funding. We'll look at education in this year's state budget decision-making process. And it's a great time to be a short person. That's according to a writer who says, despite the downsides, the modern world is more and more friendly to people who are under the average height. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear from a doctor who's studying firearm violence to talk about what that violence looks like today, some trends, some disparities, and things that cause gun fatalities. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why Wisconsin may be the ideal destination for the tens of thousands of people who've been laid off lately by some of the biggest technology companies in the business. First, within the last few days, the United States has experienced three mass shootings, adding to a death toll of 69 people who have passed away from mass shootings just in the first few weeks of 2023. And mass shootings are just part of the story. Firearm fatality rates have gone up in recent years after a low point in 2004. But who is affected most by gun homicides and suicides? Our next guest is a co-author of a new study in JAMA Network Open looking at firearm fatality trends and disparities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about longer-term trends in gun fatalities? Are there changes you'd like to see in policy, in our culture? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Eric Fliegler is a doctor in the Division of Emergency Medicine and Director of Sedation Service at Boston Children's Hospital. He's an Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Emergency Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Fliegler, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Before we get to the study and this longer-term view, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this recent wave of high-profile, tragic shootings, especially the ones in California we're seeing in the news today.
I think mass shootings are one of these totally shocking events that it doesn't matter how many times they have. Each time, it's just a gut blow thinking about them. I think that these mass shootings, we're almost kind of getting used to them happening and being more and more horrific. When I was growing up, it was the Columbine shooting, which was really the first one that got my attention. And, you know, the last few years, we just continue to see worse ones. And what is very clear is that there are no people who are safe from a mass shooting, and that they can happen really pretty much anywhere. And their randomness is part of what is so terrifying.
Now, looking at this newly published study, you're going back to 1990 here. What were you and your co-authors of this piece trying to figure out in this long view on gun fatalities?
So the gun the stories and trying to understand what is actually happening with gun fatalities over time, and how do you kind of like think about them? A lot of our article was not just about crunching the numbers, but trying to think about visually, how do we understand this and what's going on in terms of disparity? So let me kind of paint a picture for you. Mm-hmm. So we looked at 32 years of data from 1990 to 2021. And during this time period, there were over 1.1 million people who were killed by guns. You know, how do you even conceptualize that? That's more people than have died in any of the wars together that America has fought in. That is more people that have died from the COVID pandemic in the United States. And when we think about things like both war as well as the COVID pandemic, we think about all of the resources and money that has gone into trying to either fight a war or to stop the COVID pandemic. And yet virtually none of those types of resources, not even by many thousands of orders of magnitude, have been put into trying to stop gun violence from occurring in our country. The second thing that we saw was that there's just been a tremendous increase in fatalities over time. So when I started doing research in firearms, and I've been doing this research for about 12 years, the numbers have been very consistent. About 30,000 people in our country were dying every year, which is a lot of people dying from gun violence. There are no parallels really in almost anywhere in the world to that. But over the last few years, we've seen these numbers start to go up, and then they really started to accelerate around the time of the pandemic. So that by 2021, whereas we'd been 30,000 fatalities only about 6-7 years ago, by 2021, we're at 48,000 people who had died either by firearm homicide, firearm suicide, or firearm unintentional fatalities. And in the last 2 years alone, that represented a 45% increase in firearm homicides and a 10% increase in firearm suicides.
Your starting point is 1990, and that's when this, I think there were higher rates of shooting in the 1980s, 1990, then they start to go down until that low point you mentioned in 2004. How do we compare now to that 80s into 1990 level of gun fatalities?
So in terms of the actual number of people who are dying, we have more people who died in 2021 from guns than ever before. In terms of our rate, because our population was smaller then, the numbers were slightly higher at the end of the 80s and early 90s from where we are now. But on the trend that we're at, we are soon going to eclipse that probably within a year or two if things do not improve.
Talking to Dr. Eric Fliegler, he's co-author of a new study looking at gun fatalities in the United States from 1990 until 2021. Some of the most recent data, and as you heard there, increases just in the last few years, substantial ones. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your solutions. Email ideas at WPR.org or call 800-642-1234. Dr. Fliegler, the damage doesn't hit all communities equally. When we look at gun homicide fatalities, first of all, who's most disproportionately affected there?
The numbers, when we look at who dies by guns when it comes to homicides, are incredibly striking. When we look at populations concerning race and ethnicity, it is young Black males who are dying by far at the highest rates. Just to kind of put a number on it, by 2021, they were close to 140 fatalities per 100,000 people, whereas when you look at white males, it was closer to 6 per 100,000. Just to kind of quantify that means Black young males are dying at a rate 24 times that of white males. When you look at American Indian, Alaska Native, as well as Hispanic males, they're about 3.5 times that rate of their similar age white males. To put those numbers in context, when we think about disparities or health inequities between people by races, you know, when we talk about a 20% interest, 20% greater rate, or a 50%, these are big numbers. If something is 2 times greater, those are huge numbers. When you're talking about 24 times the rate for Black males, those are numbers that virtually defy imagination and are not replicated anywhere else in healthcare disparities that I'm aware of. So these are really big numbers. When we look at firearm suicides, we see a slightly different demographic. Firearm suicides, older white males have the highest rate, especially above the age of 75. But we see that these numbers continue to increase. There are high rates of firearm suicide, especially in the American Indian community. And then we see that, again, as you said before, the numbers are going up for everybody. And the group that we're actually seeing the highest rate of increase is actually in Black females. And so while there are certain groups that certainly have higher levels and with homicides, it's really almost mind-boggling to think about, everybody's still being affected.
I think that the highest profile news stories are the mass shooting homicides. Those aren't the most common, I think, gun homicide, and we often leave gun suicides out of the equation. Can you talk a little bit about how, when we're talking about gun fatalities, how much of that is suicide, how much of that is homicide?
This is such an important point, and thank you. So I mentioned 48,000 people, more than 48,000 people died by firearms in 2021. Roughly 60% of those fatalities are suicides, and about 40% are homicides. So if you really want to think where the majority are, it's in the suicides. And it's an important thing to keep in mind. And a lot of times people will say, well, you know, people who want to kill themselves are going to kill themselves, so we should just ignore that data. And actually, the exact opposite is true. What we know is that, you know, when people reach that moment of despair in their life that they decide to try to take their own lives, how they do this makes an enormous difference on whether they actually die or survive. So if you have a gun available, and most people who try to kill themselves by suicide will try within 24 hours, if a gun is available to you, you are almost always going to die. It's about 91% of the time. However, if you use pills, and pills are what are used in 85% of the times when people try to commit suicide because that's what's available, only 3% die. So that's a really incredible thing to think about, which means, you know, what's going on here? And there's many reasons. The first is that when you have an overdose, you have time. You have time to have regret. You have time to send that email, make a phone call, reach out to somebody. Your body can reject those pills. And if you get to the emergency room, we can almost always save you. But if you use a gun, there is zero opportunity for regret. Furthermore, if you can get through that terrible moment in your life where you have tried to die by suicide, but you survive, the likelihood over the rest of your life that you will die by suicide is under 10%. So we need to get people through, and that's a big deal. With regards to the homicides, you know, as I said, it's about 40% of these fatalities are homicides. The vast majority are not mass killings. Mass killings get attention. Mass killings are horrible, tragic, and they just kind of shred you on the inside when you think about it. But most of the killings, the close to 20,000 people who will die in a homicide, most of those are one-on-one type of things. With women, it's frequently associated with domestic violence, being killed by a husband or a boyfriend or a partner. And then the other people are dying, you know, it's a range of things from certainly a small percentage of them are the burglar type of thing, but the majority of them are, a significant portion are between people who've known one another and leading to these fatalities.
I'll give another number in addition to our call-in number, the Suicide and Crisis Hotline. It is now a three-digit number, 988. If you or someone you know is at risk, you think, of suicide right now, 988 is that number. We just talked about that on the show yesterday. We're talking to pediatric physician Dr. Eric Fliegler, author of a study that looks at firearm fatality trends and disparities in the United States over the last 20 years. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the increase in firearm fatalities? What do you think may be causing it? What questions do you have for our guest about his research? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Dr. Eric Fliegler, doctor in the Division of Emergency Medicine and director of Sedation Service at Boston Children's Hospital, looking at a research study that he co-authored looking at firearm fatality trends and disparities from 1990 to 2021. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the recent increase in firearm fatalities over the last few years. What do you think might be driving that? What solutions would you like to see at least tried? Call it at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Rick is with us in Monona. Rick, hi.
Hi. This is a real hot button issue with me. I think that this is the most outrageous failure of our government and legislators to legislate and stop this gun violence. People keep throwing up the Second Amendment. I was thinking or comparing it to if we were to have airplane crashes 3 times a week or 4 times a week, you can bet the government and the legislators would be on fire to do something about this. I think that this is a shameful thing that the country has going for it. And the only way I can see it stopping is if they actually get some spine in Congress and actually do something that's meaningful to stop the spread of guns, especially these high capacity and these automatic rifles like the AR-15.
Rick, thanks for that call. The semi-automatic rifles in the civilian version, but point taken. Dr. Fliegler, I don't know if you want to weigh in on the policy and politics, but do you have thoughts on what Rick had to say?
Yeah, I think this is very important, and I think his social math about the airplanes is right on target with regards to kind of how to think about the severity of the problem. So the role of legislation and regulation is really important to think about with firearms. It's a very complicated topic. It's an area I've been studying for a decade, and many people who are in this work look at. There are certainly some laws that seem to have a pretty impressive ability to decrease fatalities. Those include laws around child access prevention, which is about gun storage and preventing kids from getting a hold of them, can decrease fatalities. Laws around domestic violence and who can own a gun if they have a domestic violence misdemeanor or restraining order is important. Background checks are important. And we are fortunate that for the first time in 24 years, we actually passed our first federal firearm legislation this past summer, the Bipartisan Safety Act, which did put some things forward. But it's not going to solve all of those issues, and we do need to think about it bigger. Another area which is very frequently missed by people is this it's almost bizarre to think about it. Firearms are the only item that are sold to people, sold on the consumer market, that are not regulated for safety. Let me be clear. You buy a teddy bear for your child, it is regulated whether it is flammable, how well the buttons are sewed on so it's not a choking hazard, what about the ribbon around its neck. Yet guns are 100% exempt from safety regulations, which is why a 2-, 3-, and 4-year-old can pick up a gun and pull the trigger and kill themselves or somebody else. It's the reason why people can take your gun and use it against you, because there's nothing that registers who is the person who owns the gun. These are technologies that exist, but until we decide to regulate guns for safety, we're not making any movement here.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Tim is with us now in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Hi. In the past, we've never had a problem with guns as far as school shootings and whatnot. People say guns are weapons of war. Weapons of war, guns have been in people's hunting deer closets since as long as I'm 56, from when I was a kid. I took my gun to school for English class. We didn't have these problems back then because we had a parent at home. There was at least one parent at home to help raise kids for the most part. Our schools actually had after-school programs that included everybody. You know, there wasn't this big push, and then there wasn't social media where all these people get together with all these stupid ideas, and one guy gets the bright idea to go out and show everybody how it's done.
Tim, thanks for the call, Dr. Fliegler, to make the case that it isn't so much the guns that have changed. It's us and how we raise our kids.
You know, I think it's a very thoughtful point. I think what we have to recognize is we have to deal with the society with which we are living in right now. And in that context, when we talk about so many people dying, we need to think about, you know, what are the multiple approaches that we can use to try to reduce gun violence and people dying. We do know that gun ownership rates are starting to climb somewhat, and that is certainly going to affect fatalities. We know when we look across states, the states that have the most guns are always the states that have the highest rates of firearm fatalities. But he's right. You know, many people do own guns, and they will be safe, and their families will be safe. But we have to think about this contextually, what's going on across our country, and how do we reduce these fatalities?
Thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Fliegler, I want to talk to you about what you're hoping people will do with your research. I think of a famous early public health study, a map that showed, hey, this part of, I think it was London, this is where the cholera is happening. So maybe that's where we need to try to solve the problem. Are you hoping that your maps and your social maps of the impact of gun fatalities help us deal with these problems?
Yeah, John Snow, the father of epidemiology, understanding the geography, he's his famous pump handle is important in understanding cholera. Listen, we can't tackle a problem if we don't know where it's occurring. We can't tackle a problem if we don't know who is affected by it. And so the purpose of our study is to do precisely that, to start to narrow in where are the areas where this occurs, who are the populations that are at highest risk. We have done earlier work looking at concentrated poverty in communities that have really high rates of poverty, 20% or more dying, 20% or more of the population with incomes under the poverty level, we see fatality rates 3- and 4-fold higher than areas that have very little poverty. That's one part of the solution. Knowing where the households are, where people are dying, is another part. Knowing how guns are stored and trying to change people's thought process about, you know, do you give access to your kids to guns, or do we need to make sure they're locked up so they don't have access and bring them to school and cause harm?
Is there, I'm guessing from what you're saying, there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to gun fatalities. I'll put that into quotes. There might be one solution for those 70 to 74-year-old white males at risk of gun suicide, a different one for, the list goes on and on.
That's correct. As long as, you know, we're in a society where best estimates say there are at close to 400 million guns in our country, more than one gun for every person who lives here, and those are just estimates. When we're going to have that many guns in our society, we have to think about this as the complex problem that it is and work on a myriad of solutions. The military has worked for years on decreasing firearm suicides among their veterans, and they have different programs for them. We know that the approaches to helping prevent fatalities among children, and it should be noted that guns have become the number one killer of kids between the age of 1 and 24 in our country. That's just a hard number to grapple with. But, you know, if you are a teenage boy and you die in our country, 28% of the teenage boys who die in our country die because of a gun. We need to think about solutions that work on them. And as you said, the list goes on.
Do you feel a sense of urgency? As you said right when we began, the number of firearm fatalities has gone up a significant amount over the last couple few years. Do you see it being taken seriously?
I think that people take the idea of being killed or harmed by a gun seriously. The question is, what do they do about that? Do I take it seriously? I take it very seriously. And you know, it should be noted, when you're talking 48,000 people dying in 2021, there were probably at least three times that number, probably close to 150,000 people who are injured and then end up with potentially lifetime injuries. The way communities and families are affected, virtually everybody will end up knowing somebody who is affected by gun violence. This must be addressed. We must, as a society, kind of recognize that this problem is terrible, that it is growing, and it doesn't need to be like this.
Dr. Fliegler, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Eric Fliegler with Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. He's a co-author of a recent study on firearms fatalities in the U.S., looking at trends and disparities going back over the last two decades. If you or someone you know, again, is at risk of suicide, you can contact the Suicide Prevention Hotline at 988. They have a call. You can chat. You can text as well. Coming up after the news, more layoffs at some of the biggest technology companies around the country could create opportunities for Wisconsin's high-tech businesses. Our next guest says technology workers should consider a move to Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you now. Are you someone who's moved to Wisconsin to work in the technology industry, however you want to define that? What led you to come here? Are you hiring people, maybe eyeing some of these layoffs at these big-name companies, the Googles and Amazons of the world, for our labor pool, our talent pool here in Wisconsin? Email now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.